It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists say climate change is already having dire consequences, both in the U.S. and around the world. Rising temperatures that have worsened extreme weather events led to longer wildfire seasons and increased drought. According to the U.N. Food and Agriculture Organization, those impacts cause ripple effects as crop yields are compromised, resulting in rising food prices and disruptions to supply chains. President Joe Biden pledged to return the U.S. to the international stage on climate action, and now the country is poised to see a landmark bill that addresses emissions and energy, representing the country's biggest climate investment in history. Join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Mann is a professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Michael, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Well, Congress failed to act on climate change for decades. Are you surprised by this bill? Are you surprised that there is action being taken?
Yeah, a little, just because it looked like these efforts were basically dead just a month ago after Joe Manchin had indicated that he would not vote for anything that resembled the so-called Build Back Better plan, the original legislation that had many of these climate provisions. And so it sort of came out of the blue that all of a sudden Manchin had indeed been keeping, you know, ongoing conversations going with his colleagues, with his fellow Democrats, and that they had, in fact, come to a, you know, resolution. They had come to, you know, a compromise in the form of this legislation that was something that Joe Manchin could get behind that has real provisions. There's real climate action in this legislation. It might not be everything that climate advocates would have liked to see. And there are a few things in this bill that, you know, many of us wish wasn't there. For example, the support for additional drilling leases and other fossil fuel infrastructure like pipelines. There are some things in there that aren't great, but this was probably the best legislation that could come out of this closely divided 50-50 Senate, where, you know, the critical vote is by a coal state senator in Joe Manchin. And my view is, you know, you take the win. This is, you know, this bill has provisions that really will make a difference. You take this win now and you work towards something even better. And as we look towards these midterm elections, there's the possibility of a larger majority in the Senate that would support more aggressive climate legislation. But for the time being, this gives us this, you know, it gives us a start down this path, and it keeps alive the hope of averting catastrophic planetary warming.
Well, the bill seeks to address climate change in multiple ways. One proposal would be to provide $260 billion in clean energy tax credits. So essentially, instead of punishing dirty energy, incentivizing clean energy. So can you explain what those credits do?
Sure. And so that's sort of the carrot. And I would argue, and many climate advocates would argue, you probably need both the carrot and the stick. You want to incentivize clean energy, but you need to disincentivize fossil fuel energy at the same time if you're going to sort of get those priorities right, if you're going to level the playing field so that clean energy can compete fairly against fossil fuel energy. But as you allude to, there is quite a bit of carrot here. There are loans and grants and tax credits for business and for consumers to help further, you know, the continued manufacturing and use of renewable energy, of wind turbines and solar panels and electric vehicles. So there's this, you know, effectively this stimulus that will help accelerate this transition that's already underway from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. And when you total up all of those provisions, the effect of those provisions, and there's some provisions regarding methane, which is also a potent greenhouse gas, agricultural carbon emissions, there are a number of provisions in the bill that will help us decarbonize collectively our economy, enough so that according to estimates by a number of independent groups, including the Rhodium Group, a group of policy experts that does sort of rigorous analyses of these sorts of plans, they've estimated that this will yield up to maybe 40% reductions in carbon emissions in the United States by 2030, by the end of this decade. Now, that's not quite enough. Our commitment to the world, and we have to keep that commitment, is to lower our carbon emissions 50% by 2030. But this gets us quite a bit down that path. And there is, of course, the hope that in the next Congress, there might be, you know, a majority of senators in support of even more aggressive legislation that can get us that 50% reductions that we really need.
We're talking about the climate change provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act. It's the bill approved by the Senate and is expected to be voted on today by the House. With us is Michael Mann from the University of Pennsylvania. The legislation would provide $80 billion in rebates for consumers to buy electric vehicles, home heat pumps, and other products. What's the strategy here?
Yeah, I mean, the strategy is, you know, again, you know, a carrot. Get accelerate this transition that's already happening. You know, there's a saying that the Stone Age didn't end for want of stones. Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. It ended because we found a better way of living. The same is true of fossil fuels. The fossil fuel age won't end for want of fossil fuels. It won't end because we've run out of fossil fuels. We have five times as much fossil fuels that are in proven reserves, five times as much as is necessary to warm the planet beyond a disastrous 2 degrees Celsius, you know, nearly 4 degrees Fahrenheit. So we can't afford to burn all the fossil fuels that are even in the proven reserves of the fossil fuel industry today. We need to stop burning fossil fuels, and we need to replace that energy with clean renewable sources. The solution to the problem exists. There are some who insist that we need magic new technology to solve the problem. Bill Gates is actually one of those individuals. He's said we need a miracle. We don't. The miracle is there. It's the wind. It's the sun. It's geothermal energy. It's energy conservation. It's all of these things that we can implement. We have the technology now. We just need the political will to do it. We just need the market signals that move us in that direction. And that's what this bill really does. It allows us to greatly expand the reach of renewable energy technology while instituting energy conservation measures. And again, getting us down that path that we need to go down. Now, there are some provisions in the bill, for example, as we alluded to earlier, the expansion of pipelines and oil drilling leases, that are sort of a step back. And so this bill, in a sense, is several steps forward, but, you know, a step or two back as well when it comes to the support for fossil fuel infrastructure that's in there in part to, you know, so that the bill could garner the support of Joe Manchin. It would be nice to get rid of those provisions subsequently and to institute something like carbon pricing or a renewable energy standard, portfolio standard, which requires utilities to provide an increasing share of electricity from renewable sources. It would be nice to have a little more of the stick that you know that disincentivizes fossil fuel energy. And
so
there
less carrot here. Less carrot, yeah. more stick is what you're saying.
Keep the carrot, even more carrot, but some stick to go with it. And I think we might get something that resembles that. Again, if voters turn out in droves in these midterm elections, and we, you know, we have a larger majority in support of climate action, we can get some of these more aggressive provisions, because let's you know, make it clear, this doesn't get us all the way. This gets us 40% reductions by 2030, which is a great start. We need 50% reductions if we are to help stay on this path that averts catastrophic warming, that keeps the warming of the planet below a very dangerous 3 degrees Fahrenheit.
We'll talk more about the U.S. Senate's climate change legislation with climate scientist Michael Mann after this break. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward. Michael Mann is the author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. He's here to make sense of sweeping legislation approved by the U.S. Senate recently to fight climate change and answer your questions, too. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John from Rice Lake is with us. John, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What would you like to know?
Well, there's several points I'd like to make. I travel with RV from Washington through Nevada, Arizona in the past couple of years. And listening to NPR in Nevada, which is one of the better states for collecting solar, with solar panels, the state's energy commissioner was on, and basically what they were saying is that they don't want, it's actually against law for any resident to install more than 1,000 watts of solar panels. Now, commercially, they can install as much as they want. So it kind of doesn't make any sense. In Wisconsin, I heard a couple weeks ago on NPR the same thing from the energy commissioner, that they don't want residents having solar panels because it increases the cost for people that don't per kilowatt hour. For people that don't have solar. And the other thing I'd like to say is that in the RV industry, everybody is going solar. RVs are, almost everyone that you see out in the Midwest is solar, and it's a big growing industry, so that you don't have to run your generator or anything. You can run just about everything except AC and microwave, but most people with big money are able to install enough panels on the roof to even run those. So those are my points. But, it just doesn't make sense for the federal government to enact incentives, and then on the other end, statewide to cap it.
Okay, thanks, John. Michael, what do you say to that? What about that resistance?
Yeah, thanks, John, for, that's it's a really important point. You do, at the state level, you actually sometimes encounter disincentives. Infamously, North Carolina tried to outlaw the sale of Teslas at one point. It was their conservative supermajority that was basically doing the bidding of the fossil fuel industry and doing everything they could to dampen in their state, in the state of North Carolina, the growth of renewable energy, in this case, in the form of electric vehicles. So you do encounter this. There are conservative state legislatures that have passed policies like this that make no sense whatsoever. At least now we've got these incentives at the national level, and that's going to make a real difference. But you're right, we have to recognize the importance of our votes at every level. If we have, a president in a Congress that's willing to do something about climate, but at the state level, we continue to elect politicians. And frankly, to be honest, there's one party right now that is behind climate action, the Democratic Party, and there's one party that has opposed it at every turn, the Republican Party. We have to think about that when we vote, that every vote matters. It matters at the national level. It matters at the local and state level. We get the politicians we vote for. And if we want policies that will reflect our values, the desire for clean energy at the state level, we've got to elect state politicians who will support that rather than politicians who will simply do the bidding for the fossil fuel industry.
There's also some pushback from the auto industry because of the provisions that go along with the tax, yeah. the credits for electric vehicles, $7,500 for a new one, up to $4,000 for a used vehicle. But there's some rules there that say that those vehicles have to be assembled in the U.S. So what yeah. do you say to that?
Yeah, so that's sort of tricky, and it's made some of these estimates of you know, the net effect of this legislation a bit tricky because you have to take into account the intricacies of the these credits. And there is, you know, this provision that says that, you know, that a lot of the technology has to be manufactured in the United States using, American, resources. That is going to somewhat limit the impact that this would otherwise have, but policy experts think that can essentially be accomplished. It's going to take a lot of work to do that, but that we do have the manufacturing capacity here in the United States, and understandably, there were a number of politicians who voted for this legislation that wanted something that directly sort of supports workers and the American economy. And so this was sort of one of those provisions to try to make sure that the funding provided by the bill really does stimulate economic growth in the United States. I can see where they were coming from on that. I can understand why those provisions are there, but the caller is absolutely right. It will make it a little bit trickier to basically, mm-hmm. Achieve the sort of transition to electric vehicles that we would like to see. It's going to slow that a bit.
We're talking with Michael Mann, a climate scientist, about legislation approved by the U.S. Senate to fight climate change. The big question is this enough? The legislation is a big step in fighting climate change, but some people say it's not going to solve the problem. Is it enough? And if not, what do we need to do?
Yeah, it's enough to reestablish American leadership. And that's really important right now because if the United States isn't on the table, doing everything that it can to meet its obligations to the rest of the world, then it gets difficult to convince the Chinas and the Indias and developing countries to do their part. So it was really important. And we have that both in Biden's commitment at the Glasgow Climate Conference last year, and now codified in this legislation that the United States is working hard to meeting its obligation. Its promise to the rest of the world is to lower carbon emissions here in the United States by 50% by 2030. And that's what we need to do globally if we're going to avert a catastrophic 3-degree Fahrenheit warming of the planet. So this doesn't get us all the way there. We need a 50% reduction. The analysts, and there's some uncertainty here, but the analysts say basically this gets us somewhere between sort of the high 30s and the low 40s, probably around 40% reductions. So it doesn't get us everything we need. It isn't the solution to the problem, but it gets us on the right path and it sends a signal to the rest of the world, which is so critical right now.
We have about a minute left together, and I guess you bring up a good point here when you talk about other countries. I'm curious how you see this legislation really affecting efforts by other countries to also join in the fight against climate change.
Yeah, well, Australia just elected a new government, a Labour independent coalition that has supported a similar reduction in carbon emissions. So suddenly Australia's back at the table. They were at the back of the line. Now they're at the front of the line. The United States is near the front, too. And so I feel pretty good about where we're headed. But we do have to meet our obligations. And 40% isn't enough. We need to hit that 50% mark reductions by 2030. That means folks have to turn out in this election. These midterm elections are an opportunity for us to elect climate champions who will fight for even more aggressive legislation that'll get us all the way to where we need to be.
Last 30 seconds here. Some environmentalists are claiming that this legislation will make the U.S. a world leader in battling climate change. Is that the case?
It gets us down that path. I don't think we can declare victory yet. But this is the monumental. It's the most aggressive climate legislation we've ever passed. It comes at a critical moment where we need that leadership to basically incentivize all the countries of the world to come together. The U.S. is the world's largest cumulative carbon emitter on the planet. And if we're not leading on this issue, we can't expect others to come along. Now we have that leadership, but we have to, you know, continue sure. to strengthen this legislation. We need to pass provisions.
Michael, that is so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate having you here.
Thank you very much.
Michael Mann, a professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of 5 books, including The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Ahead this hour, we'll take a tour of the port of Green Bay, which is seeing an uptick in ship traffic. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward, News Update, and a story from Wisconsin Life are next on the Ideas Network.